vehicle. Number 2355187 and 2335198. So the appellant should please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Jeff Michalowski for the appellants, the County of San Diego, and the individual defendant, Jeremy Banks, Deputy Jeremy Banks. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And the overarching question about the trial in this case, as I see it, is how could a jury possibly award award $5 million for injuries resulting from two fist strikes and a dog bite, which lasted less than a second, that didn't require any hospitalization, and which never led to any sustained therapy, counseling, or anything of the sort. How did the jury get to $5 million, which is a number that's really outside the mainstream for cases of this type? And what the controlling law tells us is that a verdict can't be permitted to stand if it's found to be, in quote, in any degree, the result of appeals to passion and prejudice. That's from Judge Gould's 2005 decision in Watek Company that we cited in our papers. And here the appeals to passion and prejudice were really the primary thrust of this trial. And we break it down into really three critical factors that led to the liability finding and to the extreme outlier of a monetary valuation: attorney misconduct, an erroneous concealment instruction by the district court, and a direct and transparent appeal to fear. So let me walk through these briefly. First, we have the plaintiff's attorneys expressly asking the jury to act out of passion and prejudice. During closing argument, we have the plaintiff's attorney telling the jury that, quote, revenge is a dish best served cold. The plaintiff's counsel tells the jury, pointed at the defendants and said, these are bad people. They don't have even one scintilla of humanity. They don't deserve to be in the same room as the plaintiff and his family. And in addition to these highly prejudicial remarks, we also have the plaintiff's attorney not directing the jury to the damages instruction, but instead raising questions like this: is $40 million enough? Is $50 million? $100 million? We'll leave that to you so long as it's substantial, leaving the jury with the impression that it was appropriate to compare Mr. Miles's damages to the value of a modern art painting sold at Sotheby's, the $50 million Mondrian that plaintiff's counsel pointed out in the closing argument. So this was a obvious call by experienced trial counsel to get the jury to enter a verdict that wasn't based on reason, but was instead designed to punish the government and to punish the police. And we know, first case that we cited in our papers, is that punitive damages are not available against public entities. Second, Your Honors, we have an instruction from the district court that really all but ensured a verdict in plaintiff's favor, and that all but guaranteed that it was going to be a large one. The district court judge told the jury that the government had hid evidence from them, that the police had lied to them and willfully concealed evidence and corrupted the trial and taken away their right as jurors to decide the issue fairly. Really important here, Your Honors, is that this was a non-bifurcated proceeding. What this means is that the same jury that received that instruction was the same one that decided not only liability, but also the $5 million award of damages.
Can I stop you and ask a question about that? So I had understood your challenge to this instruction as being there wasn't evidence to support what the judge said happened, or something akin to that, and not to have tied this to anything about the instruction led to an improper view of what could be given as damages. Is there anything in your opening brief that you can point to that makes the link between this instruction and punitive damages being snuck in?
Off the top of my head, no. I do think that we discuss in the introduction, at least, that the overall verdict and so that the liability judgment and the damages are infected by the same sorts of errors in this case. So yeah, our contention is certainly that that $5 million figure was informed by the same errors that draw the liability finding into question. Now, there's also this direct appeal to fear. And again, we have experienced counsel here, and they accomplished this in a number of ways, but the most glaring was their photo of that vicious dog with a shock collar that they included. We included that in our papers. That went to the jury deliberation room with them. That was admitted into evidence, and the jury had this image of a dog almost frothing at the mouth.
Can I ask you about that too, though? I don't understand really how that would have made any difference, because I didn't understand there to have been testimony about fear of the dog being part of the emotional distress. It seems like what the dog looked like was never really at issue in any of the description of where the damages were that the jury was allotting. So why would it matter what the dog looked like?
I agree completely, Your Honor. It doesn't matter. Mr. Miles didn't view this lunging dog. For the most part, he's walking backwards, right? So that fear shouldn't be part of his damages. This is what is commonly referred to as a classic reptile tactic, where the goal is not to introduce evidence due to its relevance to damages or to liability, but to inspire fear, to inspire the jury to try to protect the community from harms. So putting this image, which was taken straight from a stock photo from the internet, a lot of dog bite plaintiff side law firms put this on their website.
The witness did say this is the right kind of dog. This is what the dog looked like. I mean, there was testimony. I guess I just don't see. I understand you think it wasn't relevant, so it shouldn't have been admitted. But I also just, the other side of that is it's just sort of this irrelevant piece of information that didn't tie to anything. So I don't know why I don't see any reason to think the jury used this to increase the damages, because there wasn't testimony about, like, this is a scary dog and that's the problem.
Your Honor, so as to the question of whether the dog was the same type, yes. The witness did say, yes, this is same kind of, it's a Belgian Malinois. But the comparisons ended there. The witness also said that before a dog is about to attack, yes, their ears go down like they are in that image. But there was no testimony that the most glaring parts of those images, which is the dog's baring its teeth and kind of frothing at the mouth in this military shock collar, that is not what, there's no evidence that that was anything looking like what Bubo, the animal companion or the animal partner in this case, looked like. So, Your Honor, I'd suggest that the fact of its irrelevance, yes, this image was entirely irrelevant. It shouldn't have been employed, but I think that only compounds the risk of prejudice. Just because of the nature of that photo, the jury went into that deliberation room with two photos, one of Bubo, one photo actually of Bubo, and then one photo of this militarized dog from a stock image. That's inviting, it's a direct call to passion and prejudice by plaintiff's counsel. We contend that's improper. For my remaining time, I'd like to focus on three issues, if that's...
Well, counsel, before you move on, similar to a question I asked counsel during the previous argument, if hypothetically we were to agree with you that remitter as to damages was appropriate here, and if we were to decide, for example, that we were going to exercise our discretion rather than setting a remitter amount, setting a maximum remitter amount and leaving the actual amount to the district court, what would you suggest as the maximum amount if we were going to exercise our discretion in that way to set a maximum amount as opposed to leaving it entirely to the district court?
We looked at the benchmarks, and we provided the court with a great deal of data on damages awards in comparable cases. And it depends on how you slice the data, but it's kind of striking. No matter how you strike the data, the numbers come in around $1 million. So the median is 1,020,000. The average is 950,000. So right around that seven-figure mark is what the benchmarks would suggest would be a verdict that a jury could reasonably reach in a case like this.
And does that mean that's the maximum?
No, Your Honor. The law says that, you know, the district court can't be constrained with a cap based on prior cases. But these benchmarks are clearly instructive. If there were reason to exceed them in this case, we'd want to see evidence of that. And what I think is very interesting is that plaintiff's expert indicated the types of trauma that Mr. Miles has experienced are typical of those that one might expect of someone who has a negative encounter with law enforcement like this. So the testimony from plaintiff's own expert was that this was not an unusual case. It's actually would be in line with those benchmarks. So I'd suggest that there's no reason to exceed them in this case. I do want to spend a little bit of time on the willful concealment instruction, Your Honor, because the district court found that there was bad faith and malfeasance by the county in the discovery process, and that there was prejudice to the plaintiff. And based on that, the district court informed the jury that the government was hiding evidence from them and the police were hiding evidence from them. An incredibly damaging instruction, almost impossible to recover from. That instruction was based on seven uses of force. But if we drill down on those, Your Honors, we see that there's no evidence of bad faith by the county and no evidence of prejudice to the plaintiff. Really importantly, four of those seven incidents that were included in the willful concealment instruction, those had uses of force that were reflected in critical incident review board reports. These are the privileged reports where law enforcement convenes in a self-critical way to look at challenging incidents and think about what they can do about that. The court made findings that because the county didn't include those CURB reports, those privileged reports, on a privilege log, that means the plaintiff was severely privileged because he had no way of knowing that those reports were even out there. And it found that the county acted in bad faith for the same reasons. That was a clear error, because it's inconsistent with the undisputed facts. What the facts show here is that the county did disclose the existence of the CURB reports. It did so 6 years earlier, both in verbally, in an exchange on the record at a deposition, and in a written letter that followed that deposition. So as I'm sure the court already has, I'd ask you to again look at 2 ER 197 through 198, That's the letter where the county counsel's office informs plaintiff's counsel, we're not giving you the CURB reports because we contend that they're privileged and not responsive. Counsel said the same thing.
So counsel, I have the letter in front of me. I'm familiar with what was said at the depo. Where in the letter does it say there are these reports specifically that we're not giving you, with a description?
In terms of itemization of?
Yeah, in terms of some type of itemization similar to what would actually be on a privilege log.
That itemization did not occur.
So what it says is, as discussed, there is a critical incident review board, which I view as attorney-client and attorney work product protected. But I didn't see anything in the letter which went on to say, and by the way, here's some we're withholding. Is that somewhere?
I'm sorry, were you finished, Your Honor?
Yes.
Okay. So if you look at the deposition testimony, I believe the concluding remark is, and those reports are kept in the Office of Legal Affairs. There's an affirmative statement that these documents exist. Here's where they are. We're not giving them to you because we contend that they're privileged.
I guess I read the deposition testimony a little bit more ambiguously than you do, but it says what it says.
And critically, Your Honor, in response to that, plaintiff's counsel says on the record, more work to do. So there's a recognition by plaintiff's counsel at that deposition in 2016 or 2017, I'm not recalling, but plaintiff's counsel recognizes you're withholding documents, I need to take action to recover those. So plaintiff's counsel could then have initiated the meet and confer process, could have gone to court with a motion to compel, could have served a new request for production, specifically asking for all CURB reports. There was more work to do. The problem here is not that the county withheld information in bad faith. The problem here is that the county disclosed it and plaintiff didn't take action, and then first went to the court about this issue after they were inadvertently disclosed, well after the close of discovery. So, Your Honors, was this done perfectly? I think it's fair to say the answer is no, but the court predicated its instruction on a finding of bad faith by the county, which is a fairly extraordinary finding, right? And we want to see evidence to support that. But the record, what it shows here, is actually good faith in an effort to disclose information. I'd like to briefly address the damages award as well, because the figure is one that no matter how we articulate the standard, it's going to meet that. It is something that shocks the conscience that this case with injuries that are not atypical for this type of incident, that the plaintiff received from the jury an amount that exceeds not only similar cases, but also wrongful death cases, cases where a child loses a parent or a husband loses a wife, right? So this figure, $5 million, it's not just that it's large, it's really not a reasoned decision. This was by design. This was at the invitation of plaintiff's counsel. Compare this number. If you want to look at how much to give Mr. Miles, let's think about the value of a Mondrian painting, right? Not asking the jury to fairly come up with a calculation that compensates him for his loss. That's not what this verdict does. Unless there are questions, I'll reserve my remaining 3 minutes.
I have no questions.
No questions.
And Judge Friedland, apparently, they have none right now. So we'll go to the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honors. Shay Murphy on behalf of Mikhail Miles, plaintiff and appellee. I don't even really know where to begin with this appeal. It's a case that involves a lot of very clear discovery abuses by the county that resulted in what I think are largely non-sanctions orders that were sort of set out in the form of a sanction order that then created this verdict and now has created a whole set of new misconducts by the county during the appellate process. I've never seen something like this before in my 18 or so years of doing appeals, and it's quite remarkable. And I see that the county is kind of doubling down on these arguments about how they did the discovery in this case, which was laid out very clearly by Judge Houston in his numerous orders and in the many hearings that were held on this issue. So I guess the starting point for me, and I guess, is the I'd like to start with the dog bite photo or the vicious dog photo. That photo was introduced as rebuttal evidence to the other photo that counsel mentioned of Bubo, that depicted Bubo as this very congenial, nice dog. And this is a dog that's used by police as a working dog that does a very specific kind of task. And counsel for plaintiff wanted to make sure that the jury was not given the misimpression that this dog is a nice dog, that the experience that Mikhail Miles had that night was somehow one that involved a dog that you would spend time with your children with. So the dog was never introduced, as the court was asking about, for the purposes of evidence or for the purposes of damages. It was introduced to rebut the impression of what this dog was and the role that it played that night.
Was there any evidence that that Bubo that night looked like this evil smiling dog, or that your client saw Bubo look like that?
There's a tremendous, I don't know, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that Bubo was acting extremely aggressively throughout the entire encounter, and that Deputy Banks was using Bubo very specifically to create a lot of tension and anxiety, or whatever it was that he was doing in that context. There's testimony that the dog was barking furiously the entire time. It made it impossible for Mikhail Miles to hear what any of the officers were telling him to do. And at one point, the dog actually bit Miles, and presumably, when the dog did that, it looked a lot like what the photo of the dog that depicts an attacking dog looked like. And that is, in fact, what Deputy Banks testified to, that this was a fair and accurate representation of what an attack dog that is used by the police looks like before they bite. And that's what Bubo did. It bit Miles. So I think that there's enough evidence there to lay a foundation. One, that was what Bubo looked like, and two, that Bubo was doing things like that night. I think the big issue here, though, from our standpoint, is that this case really is a product of an enormous amount of discovery gamesmanship by the county. It's interesting that they're making this argument that nothing that they did shows bad faith, and yet the arguments that they want to focus on are this sort of song and dance game that they played with the curb reports, but they don't really talk about the Valdez issue, the complaint that was filed, where the county essentially receives the complaint in close proximity to when they file their summary judgment motion. Plaintiff's counsel attempts to get the document in front of the court after reaching out to county counsel to try and get a certified copy of the report, county counsel telling them.
Can I just stop you for a second? So mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the connection between the instruction about the discovery abuse and damages was preserved by the other side, but let's just say for a second that this argument was preserved.
Okay.
Why would it be appropriate to let the jury sort of sanction the city? I mean, it seems like the discovery abuses, to the extent they deserved a monetary sanction, I would have thought that should be in a sanction from the judge and not sort of given to the jury to decide as damages.
I'm not sure I follow, because I don't know that it was given to the jury to decide as damages.
Well, I think that's what the other side is arguing today. I don't really think it was in the opening brief, I think, but the argument seems to be that this instruction that was given about discovery abuse inflamed the jury to punish the government by giving more damages.
I guess your guess is as good as mine. It wasn't briefed in the papers. That wasn't what they were arguing when they were talking about the instruction. So I don't know that it was given to the jury. I don't think that it would be relevant. I don't know.
So you do agree, though, that that wouldn't be, like, if the instruction had added and you can factor this into your damages calculation, that would be wrong.
Correct. Yes.
All right.
But
go ahead. Please finish answering.
I had an anodyne comment about how juries are supposed to follow the instructions they're given, and the instruction didn't tell them to factor that into damages award, but go ahead.
All right. So let me turn to an issue that concerns me about the amount of the damages unrelated to the concealment instruction. When I read the arguments that were made to the jury by counsel, I have real concerns that in many places, counsel was asking the jury to punish the defendants. And I'll give you a couple of examples of areas of my concern. For ER 756, we need you to say to the jury, we need you to say to the county, we don't want you to have that policy. You need to reform. You need to get your act together. At ER 761, we ask you, the jury, to show courage. Make them take responsibility. Tell them we don't like what you're doing at the sheriff's department. SER 6285, we're going to ask for significant damages for what they did to him, and also for what they need to do to reform and change their policies. And then at ER 730, not just to make this man whole, but to say that the county itself had policies in place that need to change. They need to be accountable. It's time for reform. You can do that with your verdict, you and you alone. As I read these and other statements that were made to the jury, what I see is an appeal to the jury to punish the defendants in the same exact way that there would be an appeal to punish defendants in a case where there was a punitive damages instruction. Some of these things sound just like a punitive damages instruction to me. And why would it be, how would these be justified as not as an attempt to get them to award compensable damages as opposed to punish the defendants? And that's a real big concern of mine here.
It's a good question. I think that the answer lies in, one, what the law permits, and then two, how it was presented to the jury. The concept of Monell as a liability structure is to create an incentive for entities like, you know, the San Diego Sheriff's Department and County to reform policies and practices that they have that encourage, facilitate, or otherwise endorse really bad behavior on the part of their employees and people acting on behalf of them. And so there is a kind of like an essential component of the Monell liability in 1983 actions is to create that incentive. And that was actually discussed by the court and counsel when this issue was brought up. You know, to what extent can this be presented to the jury? And the court concluded that it was fair for counsel, for plaintiff to argue that in imposing liability, you are creating that incentive. So you're doing kind of a twofold thing. One, you're imposing liability on the county for the harm that was caused, but you're also creating a deterrent for future behavior. The basics of that are is that that's a recognized thing as laid out in the brief, that is a policy consideration of Monell, and that is a kind of a fair game argument or a fair game structure for what Monell does and how it should operate. The other component to this is how it was presented to the jury. And the jury was told about this in the context of the liability argument. The closing argument was split into two parts. You had the first part, which was liability, and the second part, which was damages. And all of the stuff that was said by counsel during closing argument that had to do with reform and creating a deterrence for the county was presented in the context of liability and was not connected to damages. And so plaintiff's counsels are kind of put into these sticky situations where they're trying to present to the jury the job that they are to perform. You go through the instructions, you're going through all the items, you know, these different elements that they're supposed to establish. You're explaining to them the rationale for why this stuff exists so they can understand the job that they're to perform. But at the same time, you're kind of caught between, you know, what it is that the policy objectives of something like a Monell claim are and what types of damages are actually allowed to be awarded.
And was that, is what you just said, also applicable to, so over lunch I had a chance to reflect on the old saying, revenge is a dish best served cold?
I mean, there's a lot of extremely flowery language that's used in closing arguments, and there's an enormous amount of discretion that's given to plaintiffs and defense counsels to make their arguments. If you were to penalize a counsel for using spicy language in a closing argument, the docket on this court would be a very deep one indeed. But in that context, you're looking at a person who was, you know, the way this is being presented to the jury by the plaintiff is that you're looking at a person who wasn't a person who committed crime, who wasn't a suspect, who hadn't done anything wrong that night, and was essentially plucked, as the hand of God would operate, was plucked out of his world and put into this incredibly horrible experience. And there's a kind of expectation of tying those compensatory damages to a sense of justice, so to speak. And I think that's what counsel was speaking to. I don't think that there's a deep and lengthy appeal to punitive style damages awards, because counsel for plaintiff was very aware that this is a fine line that needed to be towed because of the discussions that they had with the court, and that it was on the one hand his job to make sure the jury understood what they were doing and advocate zealously for his client, and on the other hand not transgress into that boundary where they are asking for impermissible punitive damages. Does that answer your question?
Was there an objection about the revenge comment?
No. There weren't a lot of objections at all to most anything. I don't think there were. There was an objection to the Mandorian painting that was lodged. I think that was the only objection during actual closing.
There was also an objection, I think, at ER 807. Tell the community this isn't okay, and that was overruled.
Right, but that wasn't related. That's a voice of the community in limine argument. That wasn't, sorry.
No, go ahead.
That wasn't specifically related to the punitive component. There was an in limine that had been filed by, I believe, plaintiff's counsel related to this voice of the community argument. That was my understanding of what that objection was targeted at.
Well, the district court, in your view, okayed what you said. And in the discussions with the district court, the district court's decision was not what defendants had wanted, right?
In the context of that distinct legal issue, correct, yes. And I think, you know, you have one objection to a nearly 100-page long closing argument. It's hard to say that that's like the pervasive style of misconduct that would give rise to a prejudiced verdict. I mean, by and large, we're looking at I think defense counsel points out four instances of what it considers to be inappropriate commentary in a enormously long closing argument.
Well, we also have to look at the amount of the general damages, right?
Well, I don't know that the argument isn't that's okay. I mean, I suppose it's sort of an argument that leads back to itself. It's a tautology in a sense, like the damages justify making the argument that this is an improper style of argument.
That's not quite the way I would look at it. I would look at it as if there had been general damages of $100,000, it would be like, even if there were some error here, it was obviously harmless.
I think in this context, I know, so this is a good segue into the damages contingent or the damages issue. The $5 million damages award is not a wildly large number. This is a young man who had no criminal history, who was subjected to this horrifying and terrible experience and wound up with admittedly largely invisible injuries, but injuries that for most people that suffer from PTSD could be not just lifelong, but devastating and life-altering, debilitating conditions. And so if you take someone who's relatively young, as Mikhail Miles was, and change him for the rest of his life, that's a lot of time on this planet spent laboring under the weight of a harm that was, you know, imposed upon him for reasons that aren't connected to anything that he did other than just having the misfortune of being in the wrong place at the wrong time and having the state or, you know, the county as it were, you know, and its agents acting out in this horrifying way. So the $5 million number, when you spread it out over the entire lifetime of this particular individual who looked like a very promising young man at the time, in terms of non-economic harm, is not some enormous number. It's not a small number, but it's not some outrageously large number. So I think, you know, if you look at this from the standpoint of was the jury inflamed by these arguments, plaintiff's counsel was asking for really large numbers, or was at least intimating at the idea of very, very large numbers. And to see that the jury worked its way to this reasoned $5 million number, I think it was $800,000 for past non-economics and $4.2 for futures, it shows that the jury was not inflamed. I mean, you would expect to see a much larger number.
You mean because, so that would mean if in a future case, a lawyer asked for $5 billion in damages and the jury only gave one, that would be evidence that it wasn't excessive because they only gave the plaintiff's lawyer 20% of what he wanted?
Well, it's a factor to consider. It is something that plays into the analysis. I agree with you. If someone were to ask for $5 billion and they got $1 billion, the number, well, it would depend on the harm, but the $1 billion seems outrageous, in a vacuum. But in this context, $5 million doesn't seem outrageous given the injuries that were sustained by Mr. Miles. And, I mean, it is operating in a context where if you had a $1 billion claim, you know, an ask, and you got $2 million as a verdict, that delta between those two says something about what the jury did and how they evaluated the request and the harm that was actually sustained by the plaintiff. I do want to circle, just spend a moment on the sanctions motion, because I do find, like, deeply troubling the way that this particular appeal was presented to the court, the way the arguments were made. There was a lot of prejudice arguments that were not really founded in a factual or legal basis. There was a lot of what struck me as being purely frivolous arguments. There was a extremely distorted presentation of the record. Many of the hearings that were held by the court dealing with the sanctions issues were either not included or only a portion of them were included. The way the ruling was arrived at by the court and the analysis and reasoning that it employed wasn't accurately or fairly represented in the briefs. And, I understand that counsel is given an opportunity to be a zealous advocate, but there is a point at which the job stops being advocacy and starts being something different. And what's striking about this is that this is a case that involves, a recognized amount of misconduct and obfuscation by counsel and the county, for the county, throughout the trial proceedings. And it really did create an enormous burden on the part of plaintiff to not just have to counter the arguments and address in a very straightforward way the issues on appeal, but to have to go and, like, correct the record and actually include these portions that were excluded and give that further context and explain why what had been said is not just, sort of a advocate's position on this, but really a misrepresentation of what happened and how the rulings were arrived at. And I think that it's endemic of the fact that, like, many of the issues that are raised were not objected to. There's a kind of, like, the Miles or the Monell argument that they're making that the claim should not have been revived is kind of this absurd argument where there's a jury verdict that supports the Monell verdict, and they're not contesting that substantial evidence doesn't support the Monell verdict. But at the same time, they think that they should argue that the court should have not revived the Monell claim, even though the reason it was struck in the first place is because of misconduct they engaged in connection with the summary judgment motion. The whole thing is like this sort of Rube Goldberg device of disingenuous obfuscation. And I found that to be troubling. I've never filed a motion for sanctions in an appeal before. And I felt that this was a compelling context. And I don't think that the damages award in this context really was outrageous. I don't think it went beyond what was appropriate given who he was, a preschool teacher, and who he, a young preschool teacher, family person, and who he became, this person who was very affected by a permanent disability like PTSD, anxiety, depression. It appears that I'm out of time, so unless there are any further questions from the court?
I have no question.
No.
Okay. What was there? Time for appellant left for rebuttal.
Okay, sorry about that. A few points in response. Judge Freeland, you asked about whether the there was a link in the briefing between the concealment of evidence instruction and the damages amount awarded. We draw that out at page 2 through 3, right at the outset. We say that the $5 million verdict makes sense only as an effort by the jury to punish the county for its alleged conduct and its alleged concealment of evidence. To respond to just a few points that my colleague...
But can I just ask, so yes, that sentence is there. There's a gesture at it, but there's no legal argument where you say this instruction led to this improper punitive damages thing through the damages. I mean, I know you make that sort of argument in other places, but not as to this. And I don't think in the trial either you said, whoa, if you give this instruction, it's going to have this damages effect, and that's going to be a punitive thing you're not allowed to do. I'm not even sure you made an argument anywhere that the sum total of all of this was leading to a punitive effect that isn't proper, did you?
I don't think we used the terminology of punitive damages. We did request bifurcation, which was denied. That could have helped cure some of these issues. But yes, our contention is that both the liability finding and the amount are infected by not just by the attorney misconduct, but also by the district court's instruction.
I'm just thinking that the issue of whether this instruction led to improper damages is somehow at most on plain error review of some sort, because I mean, I just don't think this link was drawn in the trial in a way that it could have been corrected the way you're now trying to say it at oral argument today.
The willful concealment instruction was strongly objected to. I don't know if there was...
But on totally other grounds, on the grounds that it was false, and that's a different issue. And that's what you argued in your brief to us, too, was that it was false, which is a different issue than that it causes this legal problem with the damages.
I understand the court's understanding of that. Thank you. With my very limited time, I would just like to respond to counsel's suggestion that closing argument was split into a clean line between merits argument and damages argument. No, there was also rebuttal argument at the conclusion, and that's where Attorney Balaban made the explicit request for revenge, which is, I think, plainly improper. We can't sanitize this as a request for deterrence. This was a request to punish and to take revenge. Final point, the idea that there was one objection during closing to over 100 pages of argument. During the green portion of the closing argument, which was the purported damage instruction, county counsel raised multiple times, said this is argument number two, this material should not be appropriate. Those were overruled, and eventually he said, may I have a standing objection on this? And the district court said, preserved.
But sorry, what was the objection that was the standing objection? Was it about this motion in limine?
The objection was with respect to plaintiff's counsel making improper damages arguments in the closing argument, using language that wasn't tied to valuation of damages, and instead calling for, you know, punishment or a message for the community, that sort of mismatch between how the jury was instructed and how the law requires them to decide economic damages.
You happen to have the page for the standing objection was explained, what it was?
The preserved objection? No. I could find it in short order, however, and present that to the clerk if that would be helpful.
I'd like to look again at how that was presented, so it would be helpful to me to have the page.
I'd like to do that.
Just present the page sites to the clerk of the court, and the clerk will advise the panel.
Not through a letter, I should just contact the clerk?
No, I think it should be in writing.
Okay.
You do it.
Unless there are any further questions, we'll submit.
Okay, I have no further questions myself.
How about... Thank you, Harris.
Hearing none, this case shall be submitted. And again, I want to thank counsel on both sides for the excellent arguments in this challenging and difficult case. And I also want to thank counsel for appearing on short notice to do this remotely, so that we could proceed with the appeal, despite the great devastation from the fires in California. So thank you. The case is now submitted, and the parties will hear from us in due course. Yeah, let's think that adjourns us.
Thank you, Your Honors.
This court for this session stands adjourned.